Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know. The club is online at commonwealthclub.org as well as on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, founder and chief executive of the Center for Asian Philanthropy and Society and member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your moderator for tonight. Now it's my great pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Dr. Muhammad Yunus, winner of the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize, founder of Grameen Bank, and author of the new book, A World of Three Zeros, The New Economics of Zero Poverty, Zero Unemployment, and Zero Net Carbon. Zero Net Carbon Emissions, sorry. Professor Yunus established the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh in 1983, fueled by his belief that credit is a fundamental human right. His objective was to help poor people escape from poverty by providing loans on terms suitable to them and by teaching them a few sound financial principles so that they could help themselves. From Dr. Yunus's personal loan of $37 to destitute basket weavers in Bangladesh in the mid-1970s, the Grameen Bank advanced to the forefront of a burgeoning world movement toward eradicating poverty through micro-lending. In fact, Grameen Bank really was the impetus for all of these efforts. Dr. Yunus studied at Dhaka University in Bangladesh, received a Fulbright scholarship to study economics at Vanderbilt University, and received his PhD in economics from Vanderbilt in 1969. He returned to Bangladesh and headed the economics department at Chittagong University. From 1993 to 1995, Dr. Yunus was a member of the International Advisory Group for the Fourth World Conference on Women, a post to which he was appointed by the UN Secretary General. He has also served on the Global Commission of Women's Health, the Advisory Council for Sustainable Economic Development, and the United Nations Expert Group on Women and Finance. He has also been an inspiration to all of us, and I think that's why we're here today. Today we'll discuss the transformative power of social businesses to help people escape poverty and fix an economic system Dr. Yunus describes as broken. Please welcome Dr. Muhammad Yunus.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Dr. Yunus, before we talk about the book, you and I agreed that I would ask you to talk about the Rohingya crisis first. You have been quite outspoken about this topic, and maybe you'd like to say a few words about what's happening there and what you think the solutions might be.
It's quite shocking, the things that are happening in the border in Bangladesh and Myanmar or Burma, because something is happening inside of Burma, Myanmar, that is pushing people out of Burma to come to Bangladesh. And that's an attack on the Rohingyas. It's a very small community, about a million people there. They have lived there for all the generations before. This is their land. They've been there. There's no question about it. The only thing, they are different religious group, Muslim group. When Burma became an independent country from the British colony, they included everybody as their citizens. There was no question asked. Just simply a borderline is drawn in a way they are part of Burma, so they remain Burmese people. And that no question was raised at that time, any time. And they've been Burmese citizens. They had political parties. They were in the parliament, elected in the parliament many times. They were cabinet members in Burma. So those are the common thing. You have a minority community of different religion. That's how it was. But suddenly in 1982, the military government said, no, you're not citizen. We kept the citizenship. Then the problem began. Not only they scrapped the citizenship, taken away the citizenship, now they want to push them out of Burma. Mm-hmm. And they have been doing it for many years, but small groups of people pushed out. This time they go whole slow. They want to push all the million people outside of Burma. It's a, UN has said it is a textbook case of ethnic cleansing. Mm-hmm. And many governments have said it's a genocide. They killed people, slaughtered them, burned their villages, burned their homes, and people keep streaming into Bangladesh at the rate of about 15,000 per day on an average. Now it has crossed about 500,000 since 25th of August. Wow. From 25th of August today, more than 500,000 already in, and still coming, still continue. And I have been telling the Aung San Suu Kyi in a statement that I invite you to come to Bangladesh, meet these people who came from your country, and tell them that Burma or Myanmar is as much your country as it is mine. So we should be living together rather than running away from my country, our country, we go back. And that solves all the problem. Mm-hmm. But she took a completely different position. And she is the person who admired by the whole world for the work that she has done, mm-hmm. for human rights, for democracy, for all kinds of human values she has worked. And the whole world, as a result, poured in their love and respect for her. And she was given Nobel Peace Prize for that. Now, today, she's completely turned from that. She's now an image which is somebody who is taking life of people, destroying people's lives, destroying their properties and pushing people out. And she's not moved by anything at all. We have been meeting her. We have been talking to her. She doesn't respond to that kind of thing. She said, we don't know why they're leaving. This is their fault. We didn't do anything. And the whole world press is saying what kind of genocide is taking place. And you can take satellite images of the burning villages and so on. It's in the press. But still she goes on.
And it seems like you've been one of the Nobel laureates who's taken a loud voice about what the responsibilities are that she should have. And some others haven't. But you feel she's especially responsible given that she is a Nobel laureate.
Not only she's a Nobel laureate, she's also the head of the present government. She's the leader of the country. So if she takes a decision and at the same time she's a Nobel laureate, she has both the responsibilities.
Right.
The reason for which she was given this Nobel Peace Prize, she has to upgrade that. She has to hold on to that. But she has defied all those things. She forgot all of those things. Now many people are taking away her image, her photographs in their offices. Even Oxford University has taken off her picture in their gallery and so on. So the messages are poured in to tell her that you are absolutely wrong. You are degrading the very image of the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's right. Okay, well, thank you for sharing that view with us.
And I hope the whole world will get together to put pressure on her to make sure that they take back their people who have been thrown out of the country.
Do they want to go back?
They want to go back. This is their country.
Right.
It's simply they don't, the government, current government don't want them to come back.
Right. Okay. Well, now you're informed and we'll all be watching like the world is watching. When I started to prepare for this conversation, I went onto Amazon to look up the book and I noticed that it was number one in the category called Utopian Ideology.
Very good. I made it. Wow.
Which I didn't realize existed. Is it utopian?
Oh, that's up to Amazon to decide. I thought this is a very serious matter. And that's why I wanted to share this with you.
All right. Well, I think that we can all decide after you explain a little bit more about what it is. Why don't you help us to understand what a social business is?
You mentioned that microcredit that I did and started that and created a bank out of it. And now it has spread all over the world to lend money. And I challenged the whole banking system that you are wrong because you do not provide your services to the large majority, even almost half the population of the entire world are not reached out by the financial system. So we went wrong, and we have done something to fill that up. Now that it's demonstrated, you can take it up. So as we do those kind of things with the poor people, I come very close to the poor families, poor people, mm-hmm. and I notice many of the problems still beyond the capacity of the financial services. So I see health issues, terrible health. If you are poor, automatically you are poor in health. So they go together.
Right.
It's not separate. So I wanted to do something about it, and I confronted the problem of night blindness among the children. We are very small at that time, so I'm very intimately knowing children in the family and so on. So in order to address that, the practitioners of healthcare, they told that this is vitamin A deficiency. If you can somehow bring vitamin A to them, they will be good eyesight and we have no problem. So they have given me alternatives that you give vitamin A tablets or you can encourage them to eat vegetables. I took the vegetable option. I thought this is much easier to pursue than the tablet part. Then people will be dependent on finding tablets. Mm-hmm. So I tried to promote that so that people will grow vegetable and feed vegetable to children. It didn't work in the beginning. Nobody paid any attention. What I did, started selling vegetable seeds, made it into 1 penny packets. And as our staff, the people from Grameen families, Grameen Bank goes to the villages, they carry these packets of vegetable seeds and they sell. 1 penny is a very small price. They can take it and start growing them, but just throw around your home, they grow. It's not a big deal. And it became very popular. Everybody wanted to do it, not only Grameen families, also non-Grameen families, because they see it as such an easy thing to do. So land is fertile, you can grow vegetables. As Grameen Bank grew, our vegetable business grew. And at one point, we became the largest vegetable seed seller in the country. We were selling so much seed because we are everywhere at the, right. that time. We were big. And by the time we did that, this problem of night blindness disappeared from the whole country, which was a universal disease for the poor people and their children. Now that completely disappeared. So I felt a lot of strength in that. It didn't have to shake up the whole healthcare system or anything. We introduced something which worked for people. Similarly, we brought sanitation so that everybody has a kind of sanitary latrine in their home. That we did universally among the poor people, having a loan from Grameen Bank, buy herself a sanitary latrine, which is a very simple device, and it, sanitation came into the poor families. Then it put pressure on the well-off families in the villages. The women particularly protested to their men folk in their family, saying that even the beggar woman has a latrine and we don't have it, right. and we have to go out. And that brought so much pressure that finally those people started buying those sanitary latrines, and we are producing it. Mm-hmm. The reason I'm giving this example from early years, I tried to solve problem always in a business way. Whenever I saw a problem, I think about a business idea, how to address this in a business way. Right. And over time, I have created many such businesses, more than 60 such companies we created, some of them nationwide companies. And it has a common feature in them. The feature is these are built to solve problems, not to make money. Whenever I explain that, people say, no, then it's not a business. You have to make money. I said, is there a law that I have to take money out of the company? Otherwise, I'll be punished. Mm-hmm. I said, all I'm doing, I don't want to take that money. I take back the money, whatever I invested. But after that, it's all money stays with the company and it's rolled back into the company for expansion. Because these companies are created for problem solving. We never heard of a problem-solving company. I said, now you'll hear about it because you're doing that. If you like it, you can do it too. I'm not asking you to do it, but if you like it, if you want to solve problems, this is the best way to do it. Usual way you do it by giving charities. I said, charity is a wonderful thing. It has been with us for many, many years, and that's what saved humanity from disaster. But charity has a limitation. In charity, you give the money. It does a good work, wonderful work, but the money doesn't come back.
Right.
So you have only one-time use of the money. I said, what I'm doing, I'm taking the objective of the charity, but then put a business engine behind it. And the money goes out, does the work, business engine brings the money back. It becomes powerful because you can use the same money over and over again. And you can do it in a permanent way. You don't have to be dependent on anybody. Your same money, you're working. You don't raise money every year to do the same thing next year. So that's a wonderful way to do that. And you save yourself from uncertainties. When you're dependent on money coming to you every year, it's uncertain. You don't know whether they're really coming. Here, you're absolutely sure it works. People like it, and you do that. So that's the idea. And we, in one word, one sentence, we say it's a non-dividend company to solve human problems. And that's what we named it, social business.
Mm-hmm. And when you create these successful businesses, I would imagine for-profit businesses come in and try to compete with you.
Most welcome.
Yeah?
No problem. But unfortunately, most of the personal profit-driven companies don't want to do the things we do.
Mm-hmm.
They stay away from them. Like we do microcredit. They don't want to get involved with it. We do all the things we do for renewable energy and everything else. We are the one saying that, please come. This is a problem. You can solve it in your way.
Right.
But come on. Because our is a problem solving. No matter which way you are doing, we do it around here. We don't want to take profit. If you still can make profit, go ahead and do it for yourself. So we are not antagonistic in that sense.
Now, you moved in your thinking to solving that problem to realizing that there are systemic, that the infrastructure is systemically working against the interests of the poor. And I think that must be the reason you've written this book, right? Can you talk about the evolution in your thinking as to, you know, moving from just solving those problems with businesses to looking at systemic change?
Yeah. One thing with the microcredit that we did, and we continue to speak out loudly, attacking the very structure of the banking system, saying that you are wrong. Banks are supposed to lend money to people, but you do it in a very funny way. You lend the money to people who already have money. You don't lend money to people who don't have money. I said it should have been the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it should legitimate thing. But they laughed. They said, no, that's not what the banking is. I said, that's what the banking should be. So we created something. And they said, we cannot lend money to the poor people because they are not creditworthy. I said, is this the right question to say, description to give, that they are not creditworthy? Shouldn't people tell you that you are not people worthy? That's what the thing, because if you redesign yourself, then everything will work out. This is what microcredit Grameen Bank works, and then it works everywhere. We work in Bangladesh, we work in many different countries, including United States. We have Grameen America here operating, right close to where we're talking now, in San Jose, in Oakland, there are two branches here. And all over the United States, there are 20 branches now in 11, 12 cities. So it works beautifully. You have about 100,000 borrowers in the program, lending out nearly $1 billion already with a 100% repayment record. So near 100%, 99.5, 99.6, and that. So those are the kind of things. So I said, basic element, I was saying, poverty is not created by the poor people.
Right.
That's my position. And poverty is created by the system that we created. So our focus is in the system, how to fix the system so that all this terrible thing doesn't happen to people. So once we redesign it, everything happens. We redesign the financial system, we can take the people out and make them active, make them productive, and so on. I said, credit is like financial oxygen or economic oxygen to people. If you don't have it, you can't breathe. Economically, you're lifeless.
Mm-hmm.
The moment you connect with the economic oxygen to people, they become lively, they become active, they become enterprising. So it's the same people. Simply, you didn't get that oxygen to people, reach out with this oxygen, they become somebody different. So we said that has to be redesigned so that this is happening. And another fundamental thing I designed, not only the financial system, I said fundamentally, though the very conceptual framework of capitalist system is based in a flawed interpretation of human being. In the capitalist system, human being is interpreted as a self-interest-driven person,
mm-hmm.
which is basically saying is a selfishness-driven person. He only looks at himself. He doesn't look at the rest of the world.
Right.
I said the people that we know are different. Real people are different from that, the conceptual person that we have. So in order to make it practical, make it real, you have to interpret human being as a different one, who has both selfishness and selflessness at the same time. Once you make this change, suddenly the whole system changes completely. Then you have a business to make money for yourself, then business to solve the problem of others out of your selflessness. That's what I'm pleading. Discover yourself, whether you have both or you are closer to what the economists have been saying through their theories, that is self-interest-driven human being. I said, this is far, far away from the real human being. So I see everybody wants to do things and enjoy solving problems and do that. But the economics of the businesses don't allow that. you're supposed to make money and maximization of profit. So that's why we brought in the social business idea. Once we did that, everybody says, I want to do that. And big companies are becoming interested in that. They are investing in social businesses. We have now, Danone has created social business. McCain, Canadian company, has done that. And many French companies, Indian companies like Tata and others have been doing that. And now Japanese companies, Uniqlo and others have been doing that. So a series of this, and I've given examples of that in the book, describe how they are doing it. Now, it's young people interested to change the things in their own way. So they said, yes, we would like to see social business. So I said, why don't we teach the young people to learn that there are two kinds of business, business to make money, business to solve problem. And you can choose which one you want, or you can do both. There's no problem with that. You can run money-making business, same person, and do social business, the same person. But in one, my objective is one thing, and here is one objective, there's another objective. In that case, we have a completely different structure. And that structure is needed for one very important thing. Also, this is the wealth concentration. All the wealth of the world is getting concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. And I mentioned in the book that eight people in the world now own more than half wealth of the half the bottom population of the world.
The Oxfam study of last year.
Absolutely, right. Yeah, Oxfam study. And then the problem is getting faster and faster concentration of wealth. So all the wealth is coming to absolutely in one end, in a few people, not even a percentage, just numbers. Soon you will have 1% of the world. Person who will be owning 90% of the wealth of the entire world. Mm-hmm. This is the direction we're heading for. And this is a disastrous route. I said this is an explosive situation. This is a ticking time bomb. Before it explodes, we have to get busy how to slow down that process, how to bring it to zero speed of expansion and negative speed of so that this can be distributed to everybody.
Well, you just went through all of my questions.
You opened the door.
But let me back up a little bit. Yeah. And in Bangladesh, your system was radical. Not only that you lent to women, but that you brought in those same women into the management Absolutely. And leadership of Grameen Bank and all of the enterprises. Are you doing that wherever you do your work, including in the United States?
Unfortunately, I cannot.
Why?
The very reason is very complex. In Bangladesh, we are a bank with the legal authority of a bank. We have a law separately created for Grameen Bank. So as a bank, there are shareholders.
Right.
We could make them all the borrowers as shareholders. When we come outside of Bangladesh, we see everything is done, microcredit is done by the NGOs, 301C.
501c3
kind of companies. Yeah. So there you cannot give any shareholding. So you have no way you can participate, make them participate in the, unless you want to take in the board of the NGOs and so on. But that will be your choice. Here is a choice of the people because they are shareholders, and by legal requirement, they have to elect their own representative to be sitting on the board. That's why Grameen Bank is represented by the borrowers. They create the board, they run the bank, and they create the policy of the bank. Mm. So I'm appealing to everybody whenever I go outside. I said the only way to solve the problem of financial system is to create a new legislation. Existing bank that we have, I said, let me step back a little bit. I said I'm introduced, like you did this introduction, which you didn't use it that way. I'm introduced, here is a person who is a banker to the poor.
Right.
So this is, I like it. You see, I'm a banker to the poor. But I raised the question right away, if there was another banker in this panel, how would you introduce him or her? Probably you'll say, he's a great banker, he's a very successful banker, he did this. I said, the real introduction would be, he's a banker to the rich. But you don't say that.
Right.
Because that's what his bank does. That's how the whole structure of the bank is created by the legislation. This is what they have to do. I said, if that is true, then you need a new legislation to create bank for the poor. Once you do that, then they will be dedicated to doing that job. So that is the missing point, the legislative issue that you can create bank for the poor and so that ownership can be discussed and other things can be discussed. But today, that legislation doesn't exist.
So you do criticize some of the bigger banks around the world that create these small microfinance programs and and you know, we can think of ICICI and others that are doing quite a bit of it in India and other places. Is that not a good thing?
When you have a bank for the rich, you can do microcredit, but that's not your business.
Right.
You're forcing yourself because you don't look good. Mm-hmm. So you want to look good that you do that. You cannot put your attention to it, your full strength to it. You do it for token purposes, not mm-hmm. the thing. So you do that. In most of the banks who say we do microfinance, I'm just in general I'm talking about, they say that we do microfinance. Actually, they lend money to the microfinance organizations.
Right.
That's why they say we do microfinance. They don't handle it themselves. Because they, most of the time, I'm sorry to be harsh on them, so most of the time they don't like the poor people to come to their lobbies. We don't want that. We want to see somebody else handle those kind of things. And they're too cumbersome for them to deal with a small amount of money in deposit, a small amount of money in loans. They would be handling bigger amount and in one-shot deal so that they can make more money. They find it more efficient doing that.
You also mentioned in that answer that the promise of young people. And actually, there's a question here about it, and I had a question. I always bristle when people focus on young people because I feel left out. But what?
Your daughter or son must be happy.
Somewhat. No, they're both very. My two daughters are very happy to take on that responsibility. But what is it, do you think, about young people in 2017 that really equips them to think differently about business and really about the capitalist system?
Yeah, I'll come to that. But first, answering your question that I feel not bad about, I'm excluded from that. If you read the book again, probably you'll notice I'm saying nobody should retire.
Right. That's
this is my position. I say retirement is the wrong word. You're saying you're mothballing people. People cannot be mothballed. They're always creative until the last breath. They are always thinking, always working, always active. And I say that part is created by the capitalist system that you work up to a certain age, and after that, you're no longer needed. You're on your own. Because you are not as smart or as efficient or whatever reason, the cutoff date is there. I said, and you call it retirement. I don't mind you leave them on their own, but I mind the use of the word retirement, but this smells like you as if he has no use for anybody,
right.
And I get rid of him. That's not true. I said the word retirement should change.
Yes, you did say
and
that.
I say it should be phase two of our life.
Right.
Most exciting phase of our life. This is a freedom phase of our life. We are free. We are not obliged to do anything for anybody else. I do things what I want. I said that's the most exciting, most creative part of our life, and we want to enjoy that. So I'm not saying that only young people do that. I'm also emphasizing that a human being remains active and creative as long as they are breathing. That's the point I always make. So
point
coming
taken.
Back, yes.
Thank you.
Coming to
okay, I'm going to do it.
Okay, you.
Okay,
we all have to do that. We're
right.
In the same age group. We can do that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what we do, and encourage everybody else to enjoy that period of freedom that I can do on my own. I'm not obliged to anybody, not to the family, not to the children grown up. They don't care for us anymore.
I did tell my daughters to live stream this program. We'll
okay.
See.
Okay. She will listen to
okay.
That. So we are absolutely free without any attachment. And the young people, the advantage of the young people, two advantages. One, their mind is still unpolluted, uncontaminated with all the things that we are pouring into their mind, and they learn things. And when they learn things, get out of the college, get out of the school, their mind gets set. It's very difficult to undo that mind as you grow up, because now that you have owned all those things after years of your preparation. So before that part happens, that you solidify your mind that is difficult to enter, is a time that you can do things on your own. You see things with your own eyes. After that, when you grow up, you see things with your teacher's eyes, your parents' eyes, and everybody else's eyes. you forget what kind of eye you have. Mm-hmm. So as long as you have your free eyes that to see and feel and decide, why don't we do something great? We design something great so that this is what we want to achieve. This is one point. Second point is this is a lucky young generation. They're the most powerful generation in history because they have enormous power of technology in their hand. Mm-hmm. No other generation in history has so much energy, so much technology at their disposal. I said, you have a free mind, you have a technology. That's a great power. You feel that power which can change everything in the world if you combine those two. And I said, not only you know that you have power, you feel that power, and make sure you use that power. If you don't use it, it will be all gone. It will be wasted away. And that's why I keep on warning that don't waste your time because this is the most creative part of your life. When you are young, you are at the peak of your creativity. You can see things, you can do things, and imagine the world that you want to build. Don't take the one designed somebody else. You design your own world. And imagination will play the most important role. I even insist by saying, as you look at the science fiction, you get excited how science can take you in the galaxy after galaxy, do this, do that. I said, that's very important. You release your imagination power, and then science and technology follow that imagination, make it happen. Like all the things, all the gadgets we carry around today, some years back they were in the science fiction.
Right.
It didn't exist here. I said, why don't we write social fictions? Designed in imagination what kind of society we'd like to create. And if we keep on writing those social fictions and have a series in television and have Hollywood movies about it, a fiction on social fiction, and people say, hey, this is a good idea. Maybe we should do something like that. And people will start doing that. Imagination is always the kind of the mother of leading the reality. So the reality will follow that kind of path. So I encourage them to design and imagine that kind of
world. But you also have UNIS centers at universities throughout the world who give them the tools. I mean, you need imagination, but you also need...
I divided it in two parts. I said, you have the imagination, think wild things. Don't be stingy in thinking. Make it as wild as you can get. But when you start the work to make it happen, start very small, very practical. There you don't confuse. One is the imagination, one is the reality. In reality, this is the definition, you define your destination. And then you start piece by piece how to do it. And make it as a small as to make it a bite size that you can handle it. We talk about, for example, unemployment. Mm-hmm. I said, if you think about unemployment, global unemployment, you'll go nuts. How do you address that kind of thing? But when you say, I want to create a social business to take 3 unemployed people out of unemployment, I can create a social business just like that. In 15 minutes, I can design that. And you can work on it. And with your resources, you can actually build it and make it happen. So this is anybody can do that. I said, but the fact that you have created a business to take 3 unemployed young people out of unemployment, you have opened the whole door. Now all you have to do is to repeat that and improve on that, refine that. The unemployment will disappear from the whole world. So that's the way. You can do it in bite size, create the prototype. Once you build the prototype, and you move.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Now, it seems to me in my work that there is a mindset difference with young people, much more willing to take risk and do something entrepreneurial than with the older generation. You must see that where you go, everywhere you go in the world. Is that the case?
I feel it very strongly that they want to do something for another reason. Our generation came after the war's generation. Things have to be started all over again. So everybody is struggling to get their first home. Mm-hmm. Everybody started getting the first car. For the first time in the family, you have a car. This is the generation which came out. This generation starts with cars, homes, and everything. All done. Right. What do you do? So they are looking for something bigger than this. They are not interested in having a home, having a house, having those kind of things. To them, these are done. It's not exciting anymore that parents have done it, and they want to do something which their parents never dreamed about. And that's the challenge that they want to take. And we are not giving them the opportunity to do that. Make our schools and our education system is not helping that way. They're always looking for take a job, find a job, get a good job, those kind of thing. I said, job is not the ultimate of human being. But this whole system is geared toward jobs. I said, job is a very wrong concept. Human beings are not born to work for somebody else. We never did that when we were in prehistoric days. We are go-getters. That's what our name is. We are go-getters, problem solvers. We are entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. But somehow economic theory made us to look for a job. I said, forget about the job idea. They always tell yourself that you're an entrepreneur and behave like an entrepreneur, think like an entrepreneur, and be an entrepreneur. This is the most relieving thing that you can do on your own. You don't have to fit into the slot of a company or something and cut down all your creative capacity to fit that little slot. And you become a little person. You are a giant of a human being, and you make it a little Lilliput of a human being. Go into that little thought. I said, it's a humiliation to a human being.
There's a number of questions here about women and empowering women, and obviously economic empowerment is a really important part of that. Does that, in your experience, translate into political empowerment? And, you know, what women are still very much second-class citizens around the world. So given your experience, how do you translate economic empowerment into other types of empowerment, and how do we solve still the differential that exists?
Yeah. The women leadership, women status in the society still gone through lots of problems. But the amazing differences that has taken place between what it used to be, say, 30 years back and what it is today, is enormous changes that happen. Particularly if I look at Bangladesh, the country that I have been working all my life, I see what it used to be in Bangladesh 30 years back. If you are visiting Bangladesh, probably you'll not see any woman in the street in Dhaka or anywhere else, as if this is a country made of the men only. That's what they do. The women are hidden away someplace. You go to villages, if you see some women, they saw you, she will run back to home so that she is not seen anymore. Today you go to Bangladesh, it's filled with women. The whole garment industry in Bangladesh is run by women, all women workers working there. Yes. And Dhaka streets are filled with thousands of workers, women workers, crossing the roads, going to the factories, and they are independent people coming from the villages, living in the city as independent person. It was never heard of that an independent young person coming from the village, living by herself in the city. It is unheard of. Today it's happening. And all the fact that once you have the economic power in hand, that is translated into your voice. Suddenly you get a voice. And once you have a voice, that's politics begins, because mm-hmm. you have to express yourself. So I would say it is still at that level, and many things are happening, but that power is coming to the women because system is changing so that it can invite women to take the proper charges. When you talk about social business, one thing I always point out, when we talk about business, entrepreneurship, not social business, entrepreneurship. When I talk about entrepreneurship, I think entrepreneurship is the best role that women can play. Because in jobs are not created for women, actually. It was created for men, 5 to 10 or 9 to 5 or something like that.
Right.
That doesn't fit with the life of the women. You are forcing them to do that. When it comes to entrepreneurship, she's free. She does whatever she wants to do, and she's very creative and very protective of the things she wants to do, and follows that in a very methodical way. So this would be a great exposure for her to, if we can encourage them to chase the entrepreneurship route rather than the job-seeking route.
There's quite a few questions about the environmental part of the book. You do talk about how our world is not sustainable from an income disparity standpoint and also, obviously, from an environmental standpoint. Where do those two come together in how this needs to change and in your vision?
Yeah. First, I was pointing out that the social business, that we can all solve the problem.
Right.
And I invite all the businesses, big, small, medium, to create social business on the side. so that once you start doing that, you express your not only the selfish part of yourself, you also expose your selfless part of yourself. So it's consistent.
Right.
And the important thing is, if you do that, if you do the selfless part of it in the social business, then you are not contributing to the concentration of wealth, because social business doesn't add to the concentration because nobody is taking any profit out of it. Profit is plowed back into the business, so it is playing into the economy itself. So to that extent, concentration is reduced. So the more social business we do, less will be the power of concentration. So we're hitting them. And then in the social business, you can address the issue of environmental issues. Like we created the company, just one example of many, created a company to bring solar energy in the villages of Bangladesh. At the beginning, everybody said, it's a crazy idea. How can you have a solar energy in Bangladesh? This is something to be done in Europe, not in Bangladesh.
Right.
I said, we'll try, why not? We tried it, and in the beginning it was a hard thing to explain to people why you have to have solar energy and pay so much money. They said, no, it's too expensive, you cannot do that. Selling 3 or 4 solar home systems per month was such a struggle. But then gradually we learned, we came up with the idea, we tell them how much money you spend on kerosene every month. So people calculate, yes, I pay so much in kerosene. I said, okay, that's a deal. You pay me every month what you spend in kerosene, I give you a solar home system. And for the next 3 years, you just pay me that monthly amount. And after 3 years, it's all done. You don't have to pay a penny to anybody. It's all free to you.
Mm-hmm.
People love that. They said, oh, this is a great deal. I'm not spending any money, but I'm getting the whole solar home system in my house. I have electricity. And it was a roaring business. Today we have 1.8 million homes with solar energy, and it's expanding.
That's terrific.
And in the process, we don't know anything. In the process, we are told we are the largest off-grid energy system in the world.
And has that business spread beyond Bangladesh?
Many people are copying it. Many people in many other countries say, yeah, this is a good idea. I don't know how much they have done, but it has many, many followers who want. It's so easy because electricity is something everybody needs. And most of the countries in third world countries don't have electricity at home.
That's right.
And far removed areas particularly, they never will have the grid electricity. So they will be independent. When Puerto Rico hurricane came, now everybody saying, let's have a solar system in there. Of course, it's very quick and immediately you do that. And you can roll it back when you don't need it. It's a very simple thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible. If you think in a business way, if you had thought about it in a charity way, that every home will give a charity solar home system, we will have done it for 200, 500, 2,000 of them, and we'll have to stop. Now that we did it in a business way, sky's the limit. It keeps on increasing. We keep on investing, expanding, and we recover the cost. We plow back the money again. This is how it is done.
That's terrific.
And then many others. This is one about the climate change. Now we are addressing the problem of plastic. Plastic is killing everybody.
Right.
You don't notice it.
And the fish.
And the fish, because right. Plastic is passing to the fish.
Right.
And the whole plastic ocean is being created next to your sea coast.
Right.
It goes extends a huge area. It's a big plastic ocean.
Right.
And every year we are contributing about 8 million tons of plastic in the ocean. So it becomes bigger and bigger. And our whole food chain will be affected by plastics.
Right.
So we have to stop that. So we are creating, in our own way, small way, we are creating social businesses to recycle this plastic as quickly as we can in a long-lasting use for the plastic, because we cannot stop disappearing. So we have to make use. We make long-term use. The problem is created by short-term use, like the straws, like the water bottles. We throw it out after we drink the water is done. That's what's creating all the problem. If you have a long-term and you have always reuse, you will not throw it away. You'll bring it to the recycling plant, sell it to the recycling plant, or somebody will come and pick it up from you, and you're relieved, and you got some money back. And they're recycling it to create furniture, houses, housing elements, and many other stuff that you need. So this is what we are trying to do. And our first project will start in Vietnam, in Mekong River. We want to make the Mekong River plastic-free. This is our task. So how do we make it plastic-free? This is an experiment that we want to do as a social business.
That's great. When did you start that?
It's already... Preliminary designing has started. And now we are ready. We'll be working with the WWF as a collaboration, as a joint venture with the WWF and UNICEF Center. And we'll choose that Mekong River as the project.
That's terrific. So you're talking about very big system change, really. So if you are thinking big and taking your own advice and letting your imagination go wild, even though you're not a millennial, what does the world look like in 25 years?
Three zeros. So that's what we want, you see. That's the destination that we set for ourselves. And if we put together all these are not absurd ideas. It's something I can do, you can do. It's not something that, oh, some big guys will have to do it. No, because big guys can do the big things too. But we can do our own part. Everybody has a small social business along with everything else. The world will be a very different place because we learn from each other. You know what you can do if you have done something for solving some problem in a small way? Whole world will come to learn from you because everybody has the same problem.
Right.
As I said about unemployment, if I can solve the problem of four unemployed people getting out of unemployment, everybody say, how did you do it? We have lots of them. So all we have to do, make more of them. If you can solve the problem of welfare, that people don't have to be at the list of welfare so that the state can give you some charity to live for the next month. If I can take 5 or 10 of them out of welfare, not forcing them, that making them excited so that they feel that they're doing something for creative and enjoying it. And if you can do that, you have opened a whole door that, yes, it's possible. And why not you do it, I do it, everybody does it, and government says, hey, I'll be very happy because it cost us a lot of money and unnecessarily. Now that people are going and they become, instead of depending on taxpayers' money, they become the taxpayer themselves because they are contributing to the economy. It's possible. Each one of them is so simple. Simply, we never think that way. We're thinking, do I make money out of it? That's the first question. The moment you go to the making money, as if you have dollar signs in your eyes, you can see only the dollar area where the dollar is, then you don't see the opportunities for solving problem. So you have to remove those glasses with dollar signs, put on a social business glass. Suddenly you see everything completely differently. Okay. That's the whole thing.
So when we were talking earlier, I mentioned to you that I did notice that you didn't mention the role of government until page 199. let's talk about the role of government. Governments can be very powerful. They can be enabling, or they can hinder this kind of these kind of efforts. So what is the role of government in your vision, and how do we get there?
The role of government is very important, but that government has to be really a democratic government, that people really elected them with the choice. Even then, we have some kind of doubts in recent years that after all those democratic things, we end up with something else. So still, we have to have hopes that we have people that can people's confidence and lead the people. That's the most important thing, that you have enough basis that you can lead the people. The people have put your trust on yours, and you have ideas and things to lead the people. Energizing people is a very important thing. So that's the role of the government, to lead the nation in a way the nation feels strong, that yes, we are behind you, we understand, we are going to make it happen. Give the task. This is the task you have, and everybody energized. I tell the government leaders in many countries, I said, look, your job in social business is not to give us special kind of privileges, the tax cut. If you're a social business, you don't have to give income tax. If you're a social business, we give many special privileges. I said, for God's sake, please don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't give any special privilege to social business. Easiest way to destroy social business is to give privileges to social business. Because if you give privileges any kind to social businesses, then fake social businesses will start coming up. Some guys say, hey, this is a good way to make money.
Right.
But why don't you call yourself social business on the top, but underneath you do something else? So I said, in order to keep the integrity of social business, let it play with the same rules and procedures with every other business, same regulatory bodies, same rules that you have to follow and so on. And what role government can play, they ask? I said, the best role you can play, be our cheerleader. You always say that it's a great work, we like it, everybody should come and join us, this is a fantastic thing we are doing, they are doing, we help them if they need it, but they have not asked for any help yet. So if you're a cheerleader, then all the things start happening. And energize, unleash the energy of the people. That's the whole thing the government can do.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I actually just wrote an article about how many governments in Asia are creating funds for social businesses or social enterprises. And they say, well, we'll help you, the government. But the people in the civil service are not business people.
Yeah.
So the government is not necessarily the best people to help fledgling businesses.
Right.
Can you think?
I agree completely. I don't have to debate on that.
Okay.
Because I said, it's a common experience everywhere. Government-run banks are corrupt banks.
Right.
That becomes a kind of a source of political manipulation of credits and so on. So you want to help your cronies, you call up the bank, give him a loan. And since it's a government bank, they follow. And this loan will never be paid back because he knows why he got the money. So those kind of things. I said, this takes away all the principles of banking altogether. So it's not a good thing. Even the fund, if you do the fund, I said, if you're running a fund, you can create a fund, but don't manage it. Give it to somebody else to manage it. You put the money in, and you have an independent body, nothing to do with your... you give the rules and procedures for that, and stay out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because government is a political body. They are always in a short-term calculations. How I benefit by manipulating this institution that I create, particularly money. Money is something politicians cannot avoid. That, yes, if I can manipulate that, I can get this vote or get support or that kind of support in a very obvious way or in a subtle way, they do that. So I said it's good for a financial institution to stay outside and run as a social business. Not that if you give it to money-making bodies, they will be sane, they will be doing right thing. So safest thing that if you can create social businesses on managing funds and so on and so forth. I find it safer to do that.
Right. Let me just ask you about, there is around the world and certainly in this country kind of a great populist movement. And they seem to be really confronting the global elite rather than the system that created the global elite. These populist movements are not really thinking about changing the system in the way that you are thinking about it? Or have you found that your ideas have so much traction and that is something that many people can gather around?
I don't want to say something some people are doing is wrong or bad. That I don't want to say, because they may have their own objective way to achieve the good things for people. I try to focus my own work. This I feel enjoy what I do, and I said if you can try it, if you enjoy it, this is the benefit. This money can be rolled out and can be recycled again and again. Mm-hmm. So this is good. The moment you take the profit motive out of it, suddenly your mind opens up that you can do things which you never thought before. And I've given lots of examples where companies who did the same business over and over again but never thought of doing this. Danone is a good example. They have been running this business for 65 years now, Danone as a company.
Mm-hmm.
But they can do it another 65 years, but in the conventional business, they will never create the yogurt that we have created. Because their mind was never involved in solving the problem of the poor people, of the malnutrition among the poor children, and make it affordable to them. That was not in their calculation. Their calculation, which market will give us the best return, so that in the stock market we move up and everybody says, hey, you're doing great.
But now Danone wants to become the world's largest social business.
I hope so. But
yeah.
This has changed. This has impacted in them. They've been talking about it. They already created social business fund. And there is, in the process, they are creating social businesses in many countries with this money that they have created. And this money came from the shareholders. as a separate investment,
right.
Not the Danone money coming in, because Danone money could not be used for social business, because their lawyer is objecting, saying that, oh, no, you cannot use company money because shareholders gave you the money to make more money. You cannot invest in social business because social business announces out front they will never give dividend. So this will be a violation of the mandate of the shareholders. So what Danone has done, they wrote to all the shareholders that, look, we are going to start a social business in Bangladesh which needs $500,000 for us. And if here's the dividend that you are giving from the company. Mm-hmm. If you want to use a part of your dividend into this company, it's your choice. Put a tick on your box and say what percentage you want to give to the, invest in this business. 98% of the shareholders signed up. It brought them €35 million. They're looking for only $500,000. So they were very excited that they got so much money. Then the employees objected that, do you think we are second-class citizens in this company? You asked the shareholders to participate in this company in Bangladesh. You didn't even bother to ask us. So the company was forced to write another letter to all the employees. And employees came up with another amount of money, another €30 million. So in total, they got €65 million. They were looking for only $500,000 because the lawyers were objecting. So if you go to...
You mean they made money from a social business?
No. Just create this fund created.
Okay.
Then they create a social business fund out of it.
Right.
Because this money was given to invest in social business. They cannot do anything else because this, the letter says this will be invested in social business. So out of that money, now they are investing in many social businesses around the world. So this is a... You see, the lawyer says something because it's in the law.
Right.
If you go directly to the shareholder, shareholders say, no, I can do that. So if you ask people the right question, they will always give you the right answer. We assume that, no, people only want money. This is a concrete case. People didn't want money. They said, yes, we would like to invest, right. And we don't want money out of it. That's it.
And there's many other examples.
And many other examples like McCain. I gave the example of McCain, who just started social business with us, very interested in it. Then they started a social business of their own in France to buy up all the throwaway potato. This 26% of the potato grown in France are thrown away. 6% remains in the ground. They cannot collect it with the machines. And 20% is thrown away because the shape of the potato is not the right shape, because the machine cannot make French fries out of it, as many French fries out of it that it should.
No, okay.
So they don't buy it. So the farmers throw it out because they have no use for that. How much potato can you eat? So they just throw it out. When they started seeing things in a different way in a social business, suddenly they realized why they are encouraging people to throw it out. It's a good food. So they created a separate social business company. Buy up all the throwaway potatoes and turn them into potato soup. Soup doesn't need a shape. So suddenly it becomes a very attractive thing, and it's a popular soup in France now,
right?
Because it's social business soup, people love it. And then they notice that not only is potato, also the vegetable. All over Europe, 30% of the vegetables grown in Europe are thrown away. What is their problem? Because they are ugly vegetables. That's a standard
right.
business term, ugly vegetable. Why? A cucumber which is fat on one side and a thin on another side, right. Nobody wants to buy that cucumber. No supermarket will place it in their storefront. They say in the supermarket, all you have to do is to put all the vegetables in a military formation. Right size, right color, right thing.
That's right.
Same uniform. Otherwise, people are not interested. So 30% is simply thrown away. So now that new company is buying up all the throwaway vegetables, chop them up, and make it into a little package, call it ready-to-cook vegetables. When you chop them up,
that's right.
There is no shape.
It's for stir-fry. That's great.
Stir-fry.
Now, I just want to say that there's quite a few questions here with people who clearly want to create a social business, and they're saying, give me an idea. What should I do? What are the big... I hope you realize he's given about 20 ideas during the course of this conversation. So I didn't ask, but he's answered. I want to just talk to you about leadership. You didn't set out to become a leader. But you have become quite an extraordinary leader. These days, there are books and seminars and workshops and executive training sessions on how to be a leader. And yet, we seem to be suffering, I think, from a dearth of leadership, certainly in the political space. what do you think? What is it? What is a leader? And what do we need to have more leaders in the world today?
Well, leadership, first thing, I think the quality of leadership, the one has to have the imagination, a kind of imagination to see forward. They see longer distances than the other people, and people have trust in them because they feel that, yes, he will or she will lead us into a direction that I cannot see it now, but I believe what she says, and I feel excited about it, I want to join that one. So that trust is important, and a far-reaching kind of distance destination is important. These are the two important things. And you have to demonstrate that you can achieve. It's simply saying that, oh, this is a great idea, and you put it there, it does not work. The fact that you can demonstrate that, yes, you can step by step, you are moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. That creates confidence in people. The reason people look at me, because I'm doing it, I'm not consulting anybody that, can I do this and so on. I make a big jump without knowing whether it's going to work or not.
Right.
And I do it, and I talk about it when it works. When it doesn't work, I don't talk about it anymore.
Aha, the key.
Yes, because everything you do is not supposed to work out.
Right.
So you're always doing something, and you're throwing out something, and say, close it down. We have many initiatives which we started, we did it, we are very excited about it, did it 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and it's a dead end. It doesn't work. So immediately, in the meantime, we are doing something else. So we put the things, we follow the things which are working, forget about the one that finally got stuck, and move on. 4 years, 5 years down the line, suddenly, yeah, I know why it got stuck. I can do something back again. Okay. We connected with this all of a sudden, so we come back again. So we never throw away something permanently. Simply for a while, this is not going to work. Let it rest for a while. In the meantime, we keep on doing something else. We simultaneously, we do so many things. Something is working, something is not working.
Right.
So gradually, we can pick up the things which didn't work in the past, but we now understand better way, and we can connect with something which we never thought at the time. Now both them semiconductors, suddenly it starts working.
That's great.
Yeah.
So
the leaders have to have all those options. That's the point I was making. It's not just one single road that you go. There are many, many tiny roads which are crossing each other, and finally the road becomes wider and bigger.
So the leaders need to be embedded in a community.
Yeah, of course.
And learning from that community, right? You say that charity is a noble thing, but you really extol the virtues of business. So I just want to ask you, what is the role of charity?
It's very important because not immediately everything can be converted into social business. So you have to take time. In the meantime, you don't stop the charity. So I said, hold the charity world. Why don't you just start doing it 5%, 10% of the charity, see if you can do that in a business way. Try this out. Experiment with it. If you're successful, bring 5% more of that. Don't shut down the whole charity part at one go. For example, I mentioned in the book all those bidoniers.
Yeah, the giving pledge.
The giving pledge. Right. All the money they already promised to give away. I said the giving away is a wonderful thing because you're saving the world from the concentration of wealth by transferring it to your children. Mm-hmm. Instead, you have given it away. At least it's moved out from the concentration part of it. I said, instead of giving away, would you consider investing it in social business, create a social business fund, that if you can come up with the business idea, social business idea, this money is available for you. So that this money can be plowed back and again and again. If you put it in charity, this money will come to zero at one point.
And many, many foundations are doing mission-related investments now.
Very happy with that.
Right.
Yeah. So this is one.
This is happening.
It's happening. It's a mission-related investment. And we can make it more specific, saying that it's a social business, that so nobody makes out any profit out of it. Mission can also bring profit. So that
right.
I don't take personally. That's the whole important thing. So that it remains in the system, not in the person.
Not
so that way it becomes bigger and stronger.
So, Dr. Yunus, we are at the point in our program where we have one last question, and I just want to ask, we have a lot of people here who care about what you're doing and care about the planet and the world we live in, so if this is a call to action, what should we be doing maybe in addition to starting our own social businesses, or what should everyone in this audience be?
Read the book first. That's a good way to get it started. See if it makes sense to you. If it makes sense, there are many things we discussed that you can do. You can start a social business yourself. You can encourage others to become start a social business. If you are connected with any business organization already, business firm already, encourage them to create a social business on the side. You come up with a business idea to address some of the problems that you are familiar with and you want to do something, and there are so many of them. You make a list of all of them and pick one that you want to create a social business and give the idea to your business partner or the business that you work with so that they can create a parallel business on their own as a social business, try it out, and so on. And also, we hold conferences like Summit. Every year we co-hold a social business summit. This year it will be held in Paris in November 6 and 7. It is a wonderful occasion to see the whole world social business practitioners coming together, telling each other what they have been doing, what are the thoughts they have for the future, what program is coming, like the one that we are talking about, the plastic in Vietnam. This will be elaborately discussed there and so on. And then you see varieties of people who are coming from the business world, CEOs of big companies, small companies, youth groups coming together. So if you wish to learn more about it, attending that summit would be very interesting for you to just watch and listen what they're saying, what they're doing. If it excites you, you can do it. Because everybody can do social business. There's no particular class of people, whether you're an engineer, whether you're a businessman, whether you're a doctor, doesn't matter. Everybody's needed. Everybody has a role to play in it, and create social business fund. And I've said one of the things we can do, the big guys are can doing the giving pledge. We can do our giving pledge. We hand over, or after our death, we say my properties will go into investment in social business so that it doesn't enhance the concentration of wealth in any way. We raised our children the way they can take care of them. This is what I'm going to do. And spend your time and energy in thinking creatively, addressing any of the problems that we see in front of us, because we can reduce that problem in a small, as I said, bite-sized way and create it. Once we create, that becomes a prototype. That's the most important part. And I give the example of microcredit because it's very appropriate. We started a tiny little thing in one village. But now that we created it, we can replicate it in the next village and the next village. Now it's replicated all over the world. Same thing. It didn't change much. It's just a repetition. So most of the thing is like that. If you can create things, and all you have to do is to repeat it, create it. And whole world, it can be covered by whole world to address that same problem over and over again. The deforestation is a major, major problem in the whole world. We are talking about the global warming. Here we are chopping up the trees and everywhere. And all over Africa is a major problem. All over Asia is a major problem. Building forests is an interesting social business. It's an income earning. It creates lots of income and lots of opportunities for work, lots of industrial activity coming out of the forest. But it's to regenerate forest, not to cut out the forest. So that at the same time, it's an income generating. So if you address that problem in a way, you have a great idea how to reforest, how to make the forest grow again, at the same time generate income for people, that would be a fantastic thing to demonstrate. Idea-wise, it looks good, but somebody has to demonstrate so that everybody can learn from that. And then in every sector, like welfare, as I mentioned, this is a fantastic thing. And all the unemployed young people.
Right.
So in Bangladesh, what we are doing, we create a social business fund. Tell the unemployed young people of Bangladesh, come with business idea. Once you come with business idea, we will invest in your business as a venture capitalist. And all you have to do, you make your business successful, then return the money that we give you. Since we are a social business, we are not interested in your profit. You keep the profit, you just give the money back. And we can invest in another person who is looking for funding. So now we do it. In the beginning, young people were not sure whether they can run business. Now that they started it, thousands and thousands of young people come with business ideas. Every month we give about 2,000 right now, 2,000 young people investment in their businesses, and every 6 months, every year, that becomes a double. It, from 2,000 per month to 4,000 per month, and that kind of thing. So people get energized. Yes, if you can do it, if she can do it, I can do it too. So that's kind of opening up the door.
Absolutely.
Take the whole unemployment issue out of the board. That's why the zero unemployment comes into the picture.
Okay, well, we can start with buying your book, which is going to be for sale in the lobby after this program, and Dr. Eunice has very generously agreed to stay and sign them.
Thank you. Thank you.
I very much want to thank Dr. Muhammad Yunus, Nobel laureate and author of the new book, which you're all going to buy, A World of Three Zeros, The New Economics of Zero Poverty, Zero Unemployment, and Zero Net Carbon Emissions. I'd also like to thank our audiences here on the radio and on the television and the internet. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you.